I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. A fascinating book is out now that looks at how we're affected by our surroundings, whether it's architecture or the way cities are planned or our proximity to nature. Our thoughts and feelings are influenced by the design around us. Our brains and bodies respond not only to real space, but virtual space as well. The book is called Places of the Heart, The Psychogeography of Everyday Life. Its author is Colin Ellard, who joins me now. I'll get him to tell us about his book and his fascination with where we're situated in our daily lives. He is a cognitive neuroscientist at the University of Waterloo and director of its Urban Realities Laboratory. He has published scientific work in many publications around the world and has long commented on the connections between neuroscience, architectural, and environmental design. The book is published by Bellevue Literary Press. Please welcome to the Plant Online program in Kitchener, Ontario, Colin Ellard. Dr. Ellard, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. My pleasure.
So when you talk about, because people listening to us obviously haven't read the book, but and we'd like them to, because it's quite an engaging book. I'm enjoying it a great deal.
Thank you.
When you talk about real space as opposed to virtual space, the distinction there, real space, I guess, would be our houses, our buildings, landscape itself, and then virtual space would be what?
Virtual space is a kind of synthetic form of space that we can produce in our laboratory using various kinds of technology, but most importantly, a kind of head-mounted display that people can wear and that produces images of real-world environments that update according to their own movements. So what it does is it produces a really compelling illusion that you are somewhere other than where you are. And what's really interesting about virtual space and why it's so useful for this kind of research is because we know that people make many of the same kinds of responses to events in virtual space as they would to the real thing. So we can use it as kind of a test bed for hypotheses about how people respond to events in the real world and to real world places.
So if you have someone wearing one of these devices and you're testing them for, say, a change in the environment, you can know how that would affect them without having to build, say, a change in their environment at home or where they work.
Yeah, that's right. So one fairly straightforward example and something that we've worked with quite a lot is to look at how people find their way through spaces. So I think everybody has had the experience of becoming lost somewhere in an urban environment. And there are design features in environments that can either mitigate against the likelihood that you'll become disoriented or make it more likely that you'll become lost. So if we can mock up a simulation of a proposed street plan, for example, then we can get a good sense for where people are looking, where they're stopping, where they're becoming confused, where they're having to think especially hard about where to go next before any of this is built. So it's a great kind of toolkit for urban design in that sense.
And so are you finding that city planners as well as architects are using virtual space reality in say, before they come up with a plan for a city or a building?
A little bit, yeah. I think that what we see happening often is that architects and city planners will use three-dimensional visualizations of particular kinds of environments, but they're not necessarily immersive. So what I mean by that is they might produce a 3D model of an environment and look at it on a flat screen and try to make inferences from that about how people would behave in that environment. And what we do is we take it to the next step so we can actually immerse people in that very setting, and we can measure everything from where they go and where they look to how their bodies and their brains are responding to what they're seeing and sensing.
Do you and the book look at social media, Facebook, Twitter, and see how those sorts of communities online are being cultivated and how they affect us?
Yeah, a little bit. One of the really interesting implications, I think, of the blossoming of the kind of social media that you're describing is that there's a tendency, I think there's a real risk for us to downplay the importance of physical space. So, for example, if you think about public spaces, and historically how important public spaces have been to the function and the feelings in a city, there's a tendency to think, well, if we can have a community online and Facebook or Twitter or some other platform, then maybe those public spaces are less important. And I think that's really ignoring a lot of important facts about human biology and psychology and how we respond to the real thing. I think it's just simply not the case that you can substitute the one for the other. And the risk is that if we feel like maybe it is possible to make that kind of substitution, then we may neglect the importance of physical design and move towards more generic kinds of designs in real spaces.
Yeah, we've been hearing that for years now, that just because we have so many followers or so many friends on Facebook, that that can, say, replace having to actually get to connect with these people outside of the computer.
Yeah. There's different ways to think about that. There's an argument to be made that sometimes people joining some kind of social media platform will actually encourage them to make connections that otherwise might have been more difficult for them. And I think there's some merit to that. But my bigger concern, as I said, is that we'll begin to neglect our important public spaces, the physical ones. The other thing that's sort of on the radar now is that Facebook actually purchased the company that designs and markets the Oculus Rift, which is the up-and-coming virtual reality headset. And so what that suggests is that there are serious thoughts being given to kind of combining social media platforms with virtual reality, which, again, like, that really ramps up the immersive quality of social media, and again leads to the possibility that we may begin to neglect the real physical spaces and physical design, and that will be a big mistake, I think.
Now, you opened the book with this trip that you took as a kid to see Stonehenge. Because I'm going to get you to tell us that story, because I think it's illustrative of, say, what you were looking for as a kid when you get to a place like that, and say, what your dad was when he took you there.
Yeah, that adventure when I was about 6 years old was a real turning point in my life, although I certainly didn't recognize that until many years later. But it was a morning trip that my father and I took to Stonehenge back in the day when Stonehenge was a little bit less of kind of a tourist trap than it is now. It was just us, my father and I, on the Salisbury Plain looking at the stones. And as a child, I had this tremendously visceral, emotional reaction to what I was seeing, these gigantic stones that it was clear even to my young mind had been placed there for some purpose. And they had such power and potency that the feelings that I had overwhelmed me. And at the same time, my father, who was in the building trades, I think he was having some of the same kinds of reactions, but he had a much more kind of analytic stance. You know, he was thinking about the problems like, well, how did they get the stones here, and how did they raise the stone, and why this one here? And so I think now what's happened to me, and it delights me in a way, is that I have that kind of the same kind of stance that my father had back in those days, and that I stand on both sides of kind of a divide between still feeling swept up and excited and interested and sometimes even a little bit anxious about the built settings that I see. But at the same time, I want to be analytic psychologically to understand how the feelings that we get in those environments arise and how they're used.
What has your research told us about how the rest of us, say, react when we go see something like Stonehenge, or not even that, but just in terms of the surroundings? Do we think about where we live in the same sort of, I don't know if we think about it with the same awe that you did as a six-year-old kid, but certainly we may think about it analytically in terms of how we got here and how we can make the space better, say.
Yeah, I think that we both of those kinds of things. I think, you know, when I say to people that I study emotional reactions to place, then at first blush it seems like kind of an obvious thing to say, well, of course, where you are has a big influence on who you are, how you think, and how you feel. But I think that in our everyday lives we do spend a lot of time simply being unconsciously swept up by the design of space and the feelings that it might engender. But we can take that kind of analytic stance as well. And I think, you know, these days, it's certainly true in many cities in Canada. Vancouver and Toronto would be the first examples that spring to mind. There's a tremendously vibrant interest in how we develop better cities, cities that work better, cities that produce positive feelings. And so I think people are often thinking about, why is the streetscape built this way and what might be better? So in the book, what I'm trying to do is to help people to connect those kinds of dots, to give them a glimpse of some of the science that underlies what we know about how people react to places so that they can deconstruct some of their own experiences in places.
How much of the reactions that we have, whether visceral or, say, not visceral, whatever the word might be, how much of those are unconscious as opposed to, say, genetic? I mean, there must be something in our makeup that makes us react a certain way to certain things.
Yeah, I think there certainly is. I think that there is a strong biological inbuilt and really ancient set of responses that we have to spaces. And a couple of quick examples of that. First of all, in terms of the appearances of spaces, we hear all the time now about the importance of the presence of nature in urban environments. And we know from decades of study now that people have this kind of positive response to scenes of nature. It does good things for our immune system. It does good things for our central nervous system. And actually, you can draw pretty direct lines between the effects of exposure to nature and health variables like susceptibility to chronic disease. And that's something that's been there, I would say, for as long as there have been human beings. And that's the reason why we have this kind of natural affinity for those kinds of spaces. But I can give you another example that has to do with more with the geometry, the shape of spaces, rather than their appearances. And that has to do with our tendency to want to find locations that are both high in prospect and high in refuge. And what I mean by that is that we find that people tend to gravitate to locations where they feel some sheltering protection, but at the same time they can see what's going on. So if you look at a public square, for example, you're much more likely to see people gravitating to the margins of that square, the edges, where they have that feeling of comfort, but they can see what's going on. And so if you think about why we have that kind of preference, you can relate it to really basic biological principles that have to do with habitat selection. We like to see and not be seen. So in the modern day, we aren't necessarily, usually, hopefully, concerned with things like avoiding predators, but nevertheless, we still have those kind of really basic inbuilt impulses that drive us towards locations where that will be less likely. So yeah, I do think a great deal of this is ancient, mostly unconscious, and driving a great deal of our behavior and our feelings.
And do you find design can be design and architecture can be aspirational in the sense that we live in places or we situate ourselves in places that may not mean us now, but where we'd like to be, say?
Absolutely. I think that it's certainly true that we dream of architects designing particular kinds of buildings or even streetscapes that bring out the best in us. And I know that architects are vitally concerned with bringing those kinds of feelings out in people. And there are some remarkable findings in psychology, in environmental psychology, for instance, having to do with those feelings of awe that you mentioned. If you think about what kinds of vistas produce awe, then often the first kinds of things that you might think of would be natural settings, a view into the Grand Canyon, a mountain range, a violent thunderstorm. All of those kinds of things can produce feelings of awe. But we can get off from buildings as well. Think of something like a large cathedral, or even something that you might not first of all think of as being an awe-inspiring building, something like a major bank headquarters. We feel this kind of strange collection of sensations, that we're in the presence of something vast, that perhaps we're feeling a little bit differently about the world than we were. What's really interesting about those sensations and that emotion of awe is that we know that it actually changes people's behavior. When people experience awe, they become more generous. They feel more connected to others. They're more likely, for example, to be willing to help someone out or make a charitable donation. And so those kinds of connections suggest that very much so that good architecture, good design can really bring out the best in us.
Is there a formula, Dr. Ellard, in terms of what elements make an ideal place? I mean, if you had to break it down, say, numbers into percentages, I mean, close to work, I would assume, is important to a lot of people. Having contact with others, proximity to nature, something that is impressive and awe-inspiring, say, in terms of the design of the building. I mean, is there a formula?
I don't know whether I would go so far as to say that there's a one-size-fits-all formula, because one of the things that you have to take into account as well is that every city has a history and a culture, and I think good design acknowledges those kinds of individual variables between different cities. But certainly the things that you've touched on, especially I would say the importance of contact with nature, are certainly key ingredients that should be in place in any city. I would say, especially for nature, one of the things that we maybe don't acknowledge as much as we should is that when you design green spaces in cities, people might first of all think of, well, we have to design a grand park, a huge park to expose people to green space to give it health-giving effect. But in fact, modest parquets, even really small oases of green in a city, have high impact, and in many ways more impact than the Grand Park, simply because more people can get to them more often. So I would say that one of the generalities, one of the rules of thumb for any city would be that everybody in that city ideally should be living within about a five-minute walk of such an oasis of green space.
Did you find that city planners, say architects, have an eye to recognizing history and not only say reinventing a city, but keeping aspects of one's past in whatever design they're making for the future?
I think that it's certainly the case that most architects do take very special care to think about the site of a proposed design and how it connects with history and culture in the particular city in which it's placed. And I think it's very important to do that, again, because every city has its individual character. I can think of one example in Vancouver, and that is that people in Vancouver very clearly treasure their proximity to mountains and to sea. And so a design that neglects those important connections is likely to work less well than one that acknowledges those kinds of connections. So I think there are a lot of things that an architect has to get right. It takes more than simple formulas. It takes a lot of ingenuity and creativity. But I think that what they need to get right involves both those kinds of historical and cultural variables and some of the basic tenets that we understand from my field in environmental psychology that can inform how people respond emotionally to different spatial designs.
Are you seeing a bad design? And I'm wondering if you have an example of in Vancouver, perhaps, since I'm speaking to you from Vancouver today.
I couldn't think of a particular example of a bad design in Vancouver, but I would say that one of the design features that we're seeing in a number of cities, and which is of great concern to me, is that oftentimes there's not quite enough attention taken to the facade of a building. So if you think about the experience of a pedestrian on the street, what they're seeing, what they're experiencing, the built environment, for the most part on their day-to-day basis, is the skins of the buildings. They're outside. And you can exert a tremendously powerful impact on people for good or otherwise by getting the facade design wrong. So it seems like a pretty simple thing. It's just the outside of the building. It doesn't necessarily have anything to do with its functions. But if you make a long, boring, sterile building facade, say a block long facade in front of an institutional building that's relatively featureless, then we know that that's producing measurable effects on the brains and the bodies of passers-by. It's actually reducing their levels of physiological arousal. It is quite likely causing them to produce increasing amounts of a stress hormone called cortisol that we know actually has links with cardiac disease and diabetes. It shortens lives. So you might think that walking past a boring facade, it's a bit of a stretch to say that that's hazardous to your health. But if you think about those kinds of experiences accruing on a day-to-day business, a day-to-day basis over the course of a lifespan, then it wouldn't be at all surprising to discover that the cumulative effect of bad design can actually be to shorten people's lives.
That's fascinating stuff. In terms of because you look at the neuroscience of all of this, do you find that people generally are malleable? That what concerns them perhaps is an overreaction?
I think that we certainly know from neuroscience that people are malleable, that their responses to events can change over the course of experience. But I think there are all kinds of complicated interactions between that malleability and our underlying biological responses to space. And I'll give you one example that I found quite interesting in an experiment that I did in Mumbai. Mumbai is a hyper-dense city. It's very crowded. It's filled with traffic congestion. It's a complicated city for a pedestrian to find their way through. And when I went to do my experiments there, I was frankly overwhelmed by the day-to-day experience of getting around on the street. And so I asked residents of Mumbai how it was for them, and they said, oh, well, it's no big deal. You just get used to it. And so I thought, okay, well, I'm going to measure this. So I used some simple devices that measured people's levels of stress. They simply wore bracelets that were able to pick up some physiological signals. And I discovered that their stress levels were just as extreme as my stress levels. So although they might have said that they were getting used to things, and they might have felt as though they'd somehow adapted to their surroundings, the evidence in my experiment suggested that at a physiological level was not actually the case.
Dr. Ellard, I could talk all day with you because there's so much in this book. That's just fascinating, and it's beautifully written. Congratulations on it.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for your time.
Oh, you're welcome. My pleasure.
The book is called Places of the Heart, the Psychogeography of Everyday Life. It's from Bellevue Literary Press. Its author, Dr. Colin Ellard, joined me on the line from Kitchener in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.